This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And John Kerry operated in roughly the same area down in the Delta, so they do know something about the brutality of war.
Nick Terse, his book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I want to let people know of two upcoming Democracy Now! Specials. On Monday, we'll be covering the inauguration from 8 Eastern time in the morning to 1 in the afternoon. We'll be in Washington, D.C. And from Tuesday to Friday, we'll be at the Sundance Film Festival. It's the 10th anniversary of the documentary track of that festival, speaking with documentary filmmakers covering issues domestic and abroad. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Matte. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
It's 5:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the evening news.
1, 2.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor the Portland Old Time Music Gathering, taking place from January 16th through January 20th at various venues across Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering is a grassroots, volunteer-run festival that aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional, old-time Appalachian-style string band musicians. A list of performers, locations, and more information can be found at kboo.fm/2013oldtime.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
Oregon plans a ban to keep public smoking out of parks around the state by 2014.
Three Occupy Portland activists arrested last spring are acquitted of criminal trespass charges.
Oregon News Service reports that sea change is on the horizon for Oregon's coastal waters. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 15th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ford. In the shadows of the Muhammad trial, another legal court case quietly began last Thursday and concluded on Friday. The case involved three Occupy Portland activists who were arrested last spring in Beaverton. In April 2012, one dozen activists gathered in front of military recruitment offices near Cedar Hills Boulevard to rally in support of accused WikiLeaks whistleblower Bradley Manning. Police arrested three individuals from the group, all homeless people of color. The individuals, who go by the names Tequila, Nameless, and Pablo, were charged with second-degree criminal trespass, which is a misdemeanor. Activists in the group accused police of targeting the three because of their race and class. Michael Whitney from Occupy Portland was at the Manning rally last year and attended the trial last week. For more on the story, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Whitney earlier today.
Michael, can you give our listeners a timeline of what has happened to these three individuals over the last 9 months since their arrest?
Well, I think that they've been to several different court hearings that would just get them prepared for trial, and trial commenced on past Thursday morning.
All three of them were represented by who?
They had three separate court-appointed attorneys all out of Washington County.
What's your opinion on their defense team?
Well, I think that two of them, which would be Nameless's attorney was an awesome attorney, and so was Tequila's attorney. They were both incredible attorneys. However, Pablo had a very new attorney that I actually felt at times was part of the prosecution team.
One trial for all three.
That is correct.
What was the makeup of the jury?
All white. Every single one. In fact, out of the 30 potential jurors, there was not one person of color in that whole group.
In April of last year, we reported that their bail was $50, and then once it was discovered they were homeless, they were bumped up to $500, and they were charged with criminal trespass too. How much of that stuck all the way up until the trial?
They were actually housed for a trespassing too, a very low misdemeanor. Typically, and it even came up in trial, that in order to be housed or lodged into the Washington County Jail, you need to commit a felony. This is just a protest where it was a peaceful protest, and they decided to lodge them, which is a point of contention, obviously.
The trial started on Thursday. Can you walk us through the proceedings?
Sure. The prosecutor was able to bring in nine witnesses, two of which were the armed forces representatives from the Army that were there in the storefront and locked the door, and seven police officers. Pretty much what they said was is that it was a peaceful protest. There were varying degrees of peaceful.
And you're talking about the witnesses for the prosecution that's saying this.
Correct. Yes.
So can you talk about some of the defense's arguments?
You know, the defense had several very valid arguments. The one that sticks out the most in my mind was the constitutionality of the protest. They were arrested because they were on so-called private property. The defense, like so many other cases here in Portland, was that a public place where you invite people to come to do business, to park, you have sidewalks, you have a bus stop right there, it's in the middle of a busy intersection, is not solely a private place. One of the other defenses was the fact that there is no set time that I know of anywhere for an officer to be able to come in and say, okay, you must leave. And you have a certain amount of time to do so. That's just not available. So these three had 1 minute and 3 seconds. The video showed clearly that the sergeant, the officer in charge, came up to the group, who were actually on their way out, by the way, had already gathered their things up and were on their way out. The officer in charge came up to them and said, you have to leave. So in a matter of seconds, less than a minute, he said again, the second time, you all must leave, you are trespassing. And not 2 seconds, 2 to 3 seconds after he made that second, you might argue second warning, he just pointed three people out. And the video clearly shows him pointing at three people of color. One other point that I wanted to make, there's a gentleman we call Nameless, who's part of the Occupy movement, and he has what's called Asperger's. That was brought up by his attorney as well, that this gentleman has an illness that will not allow him to act quickly. And so, and I would like to make a point on that point, that the prosecutor actually, during his summation, his closing argument, that the jury should disregard that fact that this guy is, slow. That's not an excuse. And I read on the faces of the jury, it just blew them away that somebody could be so discompassionate as to say that why would you let somebody's disability affect your decision on a guilty? You know, he's guilty no matter what, regardless of his inability to react in time.
As far as these three defendants, were there any talk of any kind of restitution?
I've been discussing this with those three, and we are in the process of finding them attorneys that are willing to work on their case pro bono. But more importantly, I think even with them, more importantly, they need people, they want people to know what happened.
I've been speaking with Michael Withy from Occupy Portland. He was one of the 12 protesters out there in Beaverton last April to witness the arrests of these three individuals. He was also at the trial that started on Thursday and was finished on Friday. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
Oregon City is providing a warm place for the homeless tonight. The National Weather Service is predicting temperatures near freezing tonight in Oregon City, prompting the city to open cold weather shelters, which will be open this week as weather dictates. Father's Heart Street Ministry Cold Weather Shelter, 603 12th Street, will open at 7 p.m. and close for the night at 10 p.m. A light dinner and breakfast will be provided. Clackamas County participants in the State Homeless Assistance Program receives funding from the state for its emergency shelter program. The county contracts with Father's Heart Street Ministry to help provide that service to the homeless. Oregon Housing and Community Services said in November that there are nearly 20,000 homeless in Oregon. And Brenda Durbin, director of Clackamas County Social Services, says there's been a 72% increase in homelessness among families with children in Clackamas County. Father's Heart Street Ministry Cold Weather Shelter will accept a maximum of 40 adults, but no children or pets will be allowed.
A new report finds more children in Oregon and across the nation are eating breakfast as well as lunch at school. In Oregon, the Food Research and Action Center found that 52% of students in the school lunch program also received free or reduced-price breakfast at school. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Sequoia Wright provides more on this story.
Nationwide and in Oregon, about half the children who are eligible for the federal free school lunch program also get breakfast at school. That is a major progress, according to a new report from the Food Research and Action Center. Last year, Oregon raised the number of students starting out with a healthy school breakfast by more than 5%. Serving breakfast is up to each district or even individual schools, depending on the need and their budgets. Leslie Nelson with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says more could sign on.
Right now we're at 52 out of 100. If we could get that number to 70, that would mean an additional 39,000 kids a year would be able to eat breakfast, and we would be bringing in about $9.7 million additional dollars in federal funding.
The report highlighted figures from urban schools, but Nelson says rural schools have even more challenges serving breakfast because of the distance involved in getting children to school early enough to eat before classes begin. She says more Oregon children qualify for the meals since the recession. Crystal Fritz-Simmons with the Food Research and Action Center says some of the most successful school breakfast programs involve thinking outside the box, or the cafeteria, and feeding students in the classroom. That way, she says, no one is singled out and kids don't have to get to school earlier.
We call that breakfast in the classroom or grab-and-go breakfast, and so the kids are able to eat with their classmates. They eat while the teacher's taking attendance or doing the first morning lesson, and they're able to start the school day ready to learn because they've had a healthy breakfast.
The report says about 115,000 children in Oregon get free or reduced-price breakfast at school. For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, I'm Sequoia Wright.
The City of Portland's Code Enforcement Bureau has issued a bill to the organizers of Right to Dream 2, the homeless encampment on West Burnside in Old Town. The bill for $12,592 is part of an ongoing crackdown by the city, which accuses the organization of operating an illegal recreational campground in city limits. The monthly fine for the encampment is $1,400, and the group and its supporters have paid almost $4,000 so far. Throughout the existence of Right to Dream 2, downtown developers and entities like the Portland Business Alliance have put pressure on the city to kick the group out. Landlords leased the property at a drastically reduced rent despite its prime downtown location, and this latest bill from the city was addressed not to them, but directly to Right to Dream 2, a nonprofit organization.
Oregon State Parks will restrict public smoking in public parks by 2014. KBOO's Don Merrill talked with Chris Havel of Oregon State Parks and Recreation Today about the proposed change.
In August 2012, Governor Kitzhaber in Oregon issued an executive order limiting tobacco use outdoors on state-owned property. Most state-owned property is around office buildings and that sort of thing. He accepted state parks from that executive order, but asked us to look at policies and rules that would enforce this ban even in state parks. So we're taking time here over the course of this year to come up with some common sense rules that limit tobacco use inside state parks.
Okay, and I know that a lot of times it's usually employers who are limiting, you know, the smoking of employees on or around company property. I mean, this is going to be a provision that's going to affect citizens, ordinary people using the park system. Is that right?
That's correct. These, you know, the rules that apply to the park system are things like no littering, keep your pets on leash, and the smoking restriction would be of the same sort. It would apply to everybody who visits.
Well, I mean, with all due respect, it's a lot easier to keep your pet on a leash or to not throw a piece of paper on the ground than it is to make someone stop lighting up a cigarette.
Sure.
So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, what kind of pushback are you going to be expecting from the public?
Well, we don't know yet. Going out to the public before you start passing rules is an important step, and we're going to be going through that step over the course of this year. You know, and enforcement of all sorts of rules in state parks is rarely a matter of forcing people to comply. You present the rule, you explain why the rule is in place and why it's important, and you ask for compliance. How will this work in a state park? We don't know yet. And we don't know what the rule ought to look like. We do know that, you know, following the executive order, that it's most likely going to be along the lines of, if you would like to smoke, you can do so in your vehicle, in your RV, whatever it happens to be, but not outdoors in the state park. Most people are interested in making sure that state parks are a healthy, pleasant place to visit. And this rule sort of enforces the healthful nature of the state park system anyway.
Right. And I guess the reason why I'm asking is because in enclosed spaces or in places that are close to buildings where you have a congregation of people trying to catch a smoke break, I can understand why, you know, an employer might say, okay, no smoking in the building, go outside, and if you all want to breathe in your own smoke, that's up to you. But when you're in a state park, which is an open air environment, I'm just wondering, I mean, is the issue about secondhand smoke? Is the issue about cigarette butts? I mean, I'm just curious to know what were the concerns that made the state decide to take this step.
Right. Well, the broader purpose of the executive order, if you've got a second, I'll just read some the brief bit that sort of sets the stage.
Sure.
Creating tobacco-free state properties will improve the health, wellness, and productivity of employees, clients, volunteers, and visitors. Tobacco use remains the number one preventable cause of death in Oregon. Death and disability resulting from tobacco use costs Oregon lives and dollars. In 2009, tobacco cost Oregonians nearly $2.4 billion, with $1.25 billion in direct medical costs. And when you deal with state-owned property, for instance, it's best to have a consistent approach across all state properties rather than one set of rules if you're visiting on this state property and a different set when you're in another area. So I think it's that desire for consistency that led to a single executive order applying to everyone. But the reason he accepted state parks from immediate enforcement of this was because I think he understood that state parks are a little different. And places like rest areas are a little different and take a little more thought.
From what I understand, I mean, Oregon makes about 55% in profit off every pack of cigarettes. And in Oregon, a pack of cigarettes costs about $3. So I'm just curious, you know, if the state is successful in getting people to cut back on, you know, the use of cigarettes in, you know, public places. I mean, is the state in any way concerned that by making people cut back on cigarette smoking, it's going to cut into state revenues?
Yeah, and that's a bit beyond my purview. So, you know, I know what's going on in the state park system. The broader questions about Oregon's perspective on smoking entirely, you'd have to get that from the governor's office or somebody who's got a broader perspective. I'm just focused on the state park system here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if people want more information about the proposed changes in state parks, where can they go?
At oregon.gov/OPRD, go to our commission webpage, and you'll be able to stay up to date on changes as they come out. And when we go to rulemaking, which is where we propose some rules and people get to comment on them, you'll be able to go to our website there download the rules and send us comments back. There'll be a link in there that will direct your comments back to the right person.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill talking with Oregon State Parks and Recreation spokesman Chris Havel about proposed changes to smoking rules in Oregon State Parks.
Amid high-profile mass shootings across the country in 2012, the city of Chicago steadily racked up a 15% increase in homicides, capping at 513. Most of these homicides were the result of gun violence. In light of these disturbing figures, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has declared that the city will begin steps to divest its funds from the firearms industry. They are beginning by examining the five biggest city pension funds, which together have $13.5 million in assets. Emanuel said that he would, quote, lead a charge among mayors, unquote, to divest holdings from assault weapons manufacturers. The city's decision to divest is part of a trend begun by the California Teachers Pension Fund last week, which was in part a reaction to a national call for arming teachers.
Today marked a third full day in the trial of Mohammed Mohammed, a local resident who allegedly tried to set off a bomb during the Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland 2 years ago. Undercover FBI agents spent over a year meeting with Mohammed and are accused of urging him to engage in violence. Yesterday, the prosecution called three FBI agents as witnesses in the trial. According to testimony today reported by the Oregonian newspaper, one of those agents recalled the experience of Mohammed's reaction to an FBI-produced video that was made to look like a terrorist tape. KBOO's Joe Meyer was there and joins us for this live report. Joe, what was the scene like at the courthouse today?
It was interesting. You mentioned yesterday's session, and that really focused on Mohammed's emails, writings, and overseas contacts, with testimony from basically behind-the-scenes FBI agents. And the government argued that the defendant had dangerous contacts overseas. The defendant spoke of martyrdom. The defendant was already radicalized before the FBI came in. And, in fact, the FBI stepped in, quote, just in time. Yesterday, the defense countered that the contacts were not that dangerous, that martyrdom could also mean any kind of just death, and that Mohammed was a kid, all talk and no action. And that it was, in fact, the FBI who were sophisticated, using psychological techniques to dominate and control the confused kid. Also, of particular interest to Portland, at yesterday's session, we learned that the Portland police assisted by securing a conference room at the airport when Mohammed was stopped for being on the no-fly list. Today, the press was not allowed into the courtroom to preserve the cover of Youssef, the FBI undercover agent who handled Mohammed. The evidence today was mostly videos of Mohammed, the defendant, Youssef, the FBI agent posing as an al-Qaeda recruiter, and Hussein, another FBI agent posing as a bomb expert. The first video they showed was on August 18, 2010, at the Embassy Suites in downtown Portland. The scene there was interesting for me. The defendant was seated on the floor, surrounded by takeout food. The FBI agents stood and didn't appear to eat. The defendant was snacking throughout the interview. The prosecution typically showed a video clip and then questioned Youssef on the stand off camera to the media to first emphasize the order of events and to show the government's case. And I think secondly, to anticipate the cross-examination, which of course will try to the entrapment defense.
Was Mohammed present in the courtroom?
Again, I was not in the courtroom, but on video he was there apparently, although the video wasn't great.
And is there any indication of what may be happening tomorrow in the trial?
I think more from Youssef, more videos. I think quickly the most damaging thing today was a video, a so-called goodbye video, where Mohammed was seated on the floor. First, he had a white robe on in a red turban, and then he changed into fatigues and spoke in disparaging terms about America. It's a sin to live in America, and he said to his parents, "How could you have stopped me from?" Righteous jihad. I think that was the most damaging thing. But to me, the most interesting thing was at the first meeting at the Embassy Suites, Mohammed's speech was slurred. He would ramble on and on, and it occurred to me the kid was stoned. There's no doubt about it in my mind that he was stoned. And in fact, at another hotel meeting a few weeks later, this time at the Marriott, the meeting ended with Mohammed asking, "Hey man, you got anything to burn?" And Hussein, the undercover explosion expert, said, "Yeah, go for it, man. It's all good." So plenty to come up. Plenty will come up tomorrow. Again, the defense is talking about entrapment, which needs to show a predisposition to carry the crime, and also the ability to carry it out. The defense has talked in their opening statement about the use of social science, and we certainly saw ample evidence of that. The risk-reward program, always praising the defendant. They call him a jewel in the rough. They say his poetry is beautiful. The use of religious language to control the youth, and the use of authority figures. So I think that's what we're going to see when the defense gets a chance to cross-examine.
Well, thank you, Joe.
All right, Alex. Bye.
Again, we've been speaking with KABU's Joe Meyer, reporting live on the trial of Mohammed Mohammed, accused of the attempted bombing of the Portland Christmas tree lighting 2 years ago.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's show welcomes former KABU volunteer Laura Calvo, who will be the first transgender woman to be elected to the Democratic National Committee and will be a guest in studio to share her journey. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's episode of Hard Knock will have 5 panelists discussing gun violence. Tomorrow's weather is a strong chance of rain with a high of 42 degrees.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As Will Rogers said years ago, this country has come to feel the same when Congress is in session as when the baby gets a hold of a hammer. That's how I felt when Congress held a rare New Year's Day session to pass an even rarer bipartisan agreement. I'm not one to moan about the lack of bipartisanship in Washington, because when the two parties actually agree on something, it usually involves either putting America into war or handing out goodies to big corporations, or both. On the surface, this congressional get-together looked okay, for they met to pass the American Taxpayer Relief Act, widely touted as a deal to benefit the middle class. Indeed, there were some good gains for regular folks in the 157-page bill. But look out, the baby had the hammer. Sure enough, the bipartisan deal was riddled with huge handouts to corporate interests that hardly need relief. Goldman Sachs, for example, one of the richest banks on Wall Street, got a juicy boost from Section 328. It extends for another year the tax-exempt financing that was intended to help small businesses in New York's Liberty Zone rebuild after the devastation of the 9/11 crash bombings. Forget small businesses. Extending the Liberty Zone tax break meant that the massive new headquarters building that Goldman is erecting in Manhattan will get a reported $1.6 billion in tax-free financing. The corporate giveaways in this bipartisan bill will take $68 billion out of our public treasury this year alone. Some of the breaks will stay in effect for 10 years. Now that's relief. This is Jim Hightower saying, as Senator John McCain said of this ripoff, it's hard to think of anything that could feed the cynicism of the American people more than larding up must-pass emergency legislation with giveaways to special interests and campaign contributors.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Next week, Oregon's Land Conservation and Development Commission votes on recommendations for the state's territorial sea plan, balancing uses and protections for the area, which extends from the coastline 3 nautical miles out to sea. In conjunction with Oregon News Service, KABU's Stephen Sherritt talks more on this story.
Final recommendations for Oregon's new territorial sea plan will be voted on next week by the State Land Conservation and Development Commission. The ocean off the Oregon coast is a busy place, and several groups have spent the last few years planning how to protect fish, birds, and habitat while balancing uses such as shipping, commercial fishing, recreation, and most recently, energy development. Ben Enticknap with Oceana says the Ocean Policy Advisory Council is recommending that the footprint of wave energy developments be no more than 2% of the coastal area.
Precautionary, taking it slow and seeing if it's possible to do it right. We are dealing with new technologies in a highly ecologically important ocean ecosystem, but knowing that there could be immense benefits for renewable energy in the future if we do this right.
There's already wave energy testing off the Newport coast and a 50-megawatt plant planned for Reedsport. Antiknap says conservation groups support development if it doesn't harm sea life, including the gray whales that migrate directly through Oregon's territorial waters from Arctic to Baja California. The Territorial Sea Plan vote is on January 24th. Last year, the legislature designated three new marine reserves and buffer zones around them known as marine protected areas, sometimes called underwater parks. Antiknap says they give endangered fish species a chance to come back stronger and in greater numbers.
Some of the rockfish species and the depleted species that we're very concerned about and we think will benefit most from these smaller marine reserves and marine protected areas, they will grow up to be larger fish, producing more young and overall increasing their populations off of our coast.
The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is collecting baseline data about the protected areas before the fishing restrictions start in 2014 or at Cape Falcon in 2016. Oregon is taking cues from California, which completed its network of marine protected areas in December. The new ones stretch from the Oregon border to south of Fort Bragg. Karen Garrison with the Natural Resources Defense Council says many of the NPAs are located near public beaches and state parks, where they've been a boost for local economies.
In the Channel Islands, we saw an increase in scuba diving and kayaking in the protected areas. That's going to be true throughout the state. These areas will draw people to the coast. At the same time, they'll have protections in place that make sure that we are using those places sustainably.
Reporting for KBOO News, this is Stephen Sherritt.
Today, the Associated Press reports that Democrats in New York State Capitol Albany prepared to pass the toughest gun control law in the nation. The legislation, approved and drafted by Governor Andrew Cuomo, passed in the Senate by a Republican-dominated coalition late Monday night, and is expected to pass in the Democrat-led Assembly today. The statewide measure will redefine assault weapons as having one, not two, military rifle features, such as a folding stock, a pistol grip, a muzzle flash suppressor, or a bayonet mount. Other changes to state law will include background checks on private sales, required registration by current owners, including police officers, of assault weapons, the barred purchase of assault weapons over the internet, and misdemeanor charges for failure to safely store weapons. New restrictions on ammunition magazines were also set, restricting the capacity of magazines from 10 to 7 bullets. Ammunition sellers will also be required to run background checks, keep databases of sales, and register with the state. The Webster provision, referencing the shooting of two firefighters last month in Webster, New York, was also introduced. The provision increases sentences for gun crimes and requires therapists, psychologists, registered nurses, and licensed social workers to report any mental health directors and the state.